You know, it says recording and I've, okay.
Oh, there we go. There we go. You guys can hear me, right?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Well, perfect. All right. So we got the Yeti now. And I got an AirPods and I got the camera. We're all set.
It's time for the Access of Easy podcast.
Sorry for the difficulty, but it looks like we made it work perfectly. So
it's all fine. Welcome,
all right,
one and all, to the Access of Easy Salon. This is number 32. We're recording this on November 25th. Charles is under the weather this week. He can't make it on. We have a very special guest in Dimitri Kafinas, who is the host of the Hidden Forces podcast. Dimitri is a technology and media entrepreneur. He was a producer of the show Capital Account, which used to run on RT. He runs Offline, a Broadway theater company that does modern adaptations of classic plays. And you also run the site Art of Dying, an education initiative to tackle society's relationship with death and dying. And just an overall extremely interesting person who does the most in-depth interviews with the most interesting people around, Dimitri Kafinas. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you, Mark. I probably need to update that bio.
It's a little out of date.
Oh yeah. Okay. I haven't put on a theatrical production like I think 4 years or something, and The Art of Dying was about 5 years ago. So
that probably would have been about the time that you were coming to grips with your brain tumor and your dementia and that sort of thing, I would imagine.
It was a 2 years I was diagnosed in 2009 and I had brain surgery in 2013. And I started the theater company in 2015, around the same time that I put on that conference on The Art of Dying. Yeah.
Yeah. I've heard you.
This is.
Go ahead, Jeff.
As an active listener, this is all news to me. And it certainly, I think, gives greater depth to my appreciation of your fantastic work. But it begs the obvious starting question, you know, how did Hidden Forces come about?
I'm supposed to have a good answer to this question. Hidden Forces started in the summer of 2016. It was partly a result of the fact that I was doing a lot of like introspective work. I wrote an article for Quartz Magazine, which was basically a large story of my brain tumor. And it was also partly a result of the 2016 election and Donald Trump's victory in the primary, and just how, you know, I think partisan America had become. So that inspired the more objective, nonpartisan approach that I take on Hidden Forces. And I was just in a place of like wonder and self-discovery. Ever since my surgery, I was kind of wandering around trying to figure out what I wanted to do with my life. I wasn't inspired to do anything in finance or economics anymore. I wasn't reading much. And it took a few years, you know, sometimes that things happen that way. And things came together in that summer. And I read a lot of books and I asked myself a lot of questions about what it was that I loved about Capital Account, which was my old television show, so much. And I came to this vision of creating a show that would transcend finance and kind of cover all these issues, whether they're geopolitical, finance, culture, technology, dealing with what I called the hidden forces, the fundamental foundational forces that drive the larger changes that we all experience on a day-to-day basis, whether it's in markets or whether it's in our lives or in our jobs.
One of the things I like about the show, and you mentioned it, that you wanted to make like a more nonpartisan, objectively situated show, because for my own part, I lean libertarian. Sometimes I go full anarcho-capitalist, and I found myself maybe 12, 18 months ago I felt myself almost being too radical, too far polarized. And so your show was one of the shows that I was starting to listen to that just sort of helped me take a couple of steps backward towards, we don't like to call it the centrism or the center, but just moderation, just sort of like it's not almost depolarizing myself or de-radicalizing myself in the sense of just, okay, we don't have to be all or nothing on one side of the scale or the other. We can, there's actually, there's a lot of nuance to pretty well everything. And that's one of the things I liked about how you covered the material in your show.
Thanks. Yeah. I mean, that was one of the objectives. I wanted to be inviting. And part of that also meant stepping back a bit and trying not to impede the conversation with my own opinion. And that was also something that, you know, it took some time because with Capital Account, even though I was on air on Capital Account, but it was at the very end of the program, I had a very strong opinion and that came through in the editorial of the program. In this case, I didn't want that to happen. So it's by design, because I think we live in a time now where everybody's got an opinion and everyone, you know, blurts it out, and news anchors have become semi-celebrities, and it's just a lot of moralizing regardless of what network you're looking at. So I didn't want it to be like that, you know, which was a challenge too, because so many people are used to figuring out where you stand and then deciding whether they want to listen to you or not. So that was kind of breaking new ground in that way.
Well, and certainly where I identify with you as the host is your curiosity that, you know, when you're interviewing someone, you're really good at kind of bringing out their knowledge, bringing out sort of the gems that they've either worked on throughout their career or that is the byproduct of them producing, say, a book. And, you know, it's interesting, like where Mark, I think, seeks that kind of objectivity, nonpartisan, I very much seek position. I'm interested in people who are sort of caving out of position and putting forth an argument. And that's your guests. And the way in which you bring that out of your guests as a kind of curiosity is something I find really refreshing and really inviting as a listener. How do you choose your guests? How do you sort of, you know, where's your curiosity come from? Because you're clearly a kind of a ravenous learner who's, you know, always hungry for more knowledge. So what drives that? What motivates you to keep on being hungry in that regard?
It's a great question. I don't know. I've always been an energetic person. Like, I was always into sports and fitness and stuff like that. And I feel like some of that also drives my curiosity, just the general energy. But I've always been very curious, and I've always wondered about things. And once I learned at some point in my life that I could overcome intellectual obstacles on my own, it felt very empowering. You know, like you guys, it sounds like both have an economic background, whether that's a university background or whether that's a background that you cultivated on your own. Am I right about that? Or you said something earlier, or maybe not. You guys said something that made me think that. Anyway, I studied economics and political science in school. The political science degree was actually much more useful because it was there was theory, and the game theory that you learn, which is primarily the theory that you learn in political science, and you learn like realism and stuff like that. Those things are actually useful and applicable, but you also learn a lot of history. In economics, you don't learn a lot of history. In fact, I remember there was one course and it was called economic history. and it's mostly, you know, defunct theories that are borrowed from, you know, physics and applied in economics. So I had to relearn a lot of stuff coming out of school, and I on my own began to learn. I wasn't kind of made to sit in a class and listen to a lecture. But I always was curious. As far as and I don't really know where it comes from. I think it's just kind of innate. And in terms of guests, how I come up with guests, it's a good question. It's a process. It's not like something that just happens. And especially because I, for the most part, only do one episode a week. Sometimes I do two. I did two this week. I have some time to consider my guests. Like the guest that comes out this coming Monday, Thomas Ricks, he had written the book Fiasco. Do you guys remember that book?
Mm-hmm.
He's out with a new book called First Principles. And it's a history of the revolutionary 18th century America.
Hmm.
His publicists reached out to me. But in other cases, like David Shore, who's going to come on the show, I discovered his work after the elections or right before the elections this year when I was researching, trying to get a better grasp on the, yeah, it was actually after the elections, because I saw the election results that that support by non-whites had increased for Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. And that actually to me didn't feel surprising, because I, or at least I thought, no, I'm not surprised, because the whole narrative that the reason that Donald Trump got elected was because of white supremacy, and, you know, just never really was enough for me. It wasn't a coherent narrative. And so I found his stuff. I read it and I thought he'd be an interesting guy to speak to. Other times that, you know, other times it might be the topic. So I'm like, okay, you know, I really want to do a topic on this. Who would be a great guest on that? And an example of that is someone who's going to be coming on probably in December to talk about border wars and border conflicts. Mm-hmm. Because I had in my mind, okay, as we're moving towards this multipolar world, where are we more likely to see outbreaks of conflict? We're more likely to see them in these kind of frozen conflict zones, places that have been held together because of the unipolar world, because of American supremacy. So, you know, it depends. It really does depend. Sometimes it might just be, and this is rare, but sometimes it might be, wow, this is really topical. Who can I bring on right now? Mm-hmm. But that's less common.
Well, and, you know, Mark and I are both Canadian, which, you know, Canadians share quite a bit in common with Americans, except for the one fact that we're not Americans. And one of the frustrating things really about Americans, especially American media personalities, is how insular they can be. That, you know, it's America or nothing. And it's, you know, the kind of navel gazing. Versus what I love about your show is its international perspective. And I tend to learn things about parts of the world, which quite honestly, I rarely do from Americans. And so, you know, where's that influence coming from? How have you, not just the curiosity, but how come you're so interested in sort of international affairs in general?
Sure. I'd love to hear, after I answer the question, what part of Canada are you guys from? Because it is a beautiful country. What was the question again?
Your international curiosity.
Oh, international,
right?
Curiosity.
Which is, you have to admit, it's kind of rare for Americans to have that.
Yeah. Well, I'm Greek American. I was born in Cincinnati right after my parents moved here, and we moved around a lot growing up, and we went back to Greece every single summer. I've also lived abroad. I've lived in Italy and worked in Italy. I speak Italian and I speak Greek. So I have an international perspective. Mm-hmm. So that comes pretty naturally to me. That's probably the best answer. You know, I've traveled a lot.
Right on.
Yeah. What part of Canada are you guys from, by the way? Don't mean to hijack the conversation.
No, by all means.
Well, you're the guest. So I'm in Toronto, and Jesse grew up in Toronto, but you are now in the Ottawa Valley.
So. Yeah, I fled the city, deciding that and didn't realize a pandemic was coming. But boy, did it pay off in terms of.
Is that your home right there behind there? Is that your
home? Yeah, that's my barn.
What is that animal right there?
That's one of our horses. So here,
I can't tell from over here. It looks like a tiger, like a Siberian tiger.
Jesse is now unconsciously perpetuating every stereotype about Canada that Americans hold. You just need an igloo in the background, and then the picture would be complete.
One of my favorite trips ever was to Vancouver. It's a beautiful city. My fiance and I moved out of the city. We both have our apartments, but we moved out to a rural part of the country, out of New York. And we've been actually looking for kind of farm property to buy. Mm-hmm. Like I saw you have chickens there and stuff. And I don't know if we would start with a chicken coop, because I mean, we would kind of be like Ben Hunt says, dilettante farmers. And chicken coops, there's a lot of shit you got to clean up and stuff. Yes. So, because my grandmother used to, all my summers were spent in Greece, and my family was from kind of the outskirts of about 3 hours out of Athens, small town, you know, so my grandmother had chickens and stuff. We love it out here. We love being in the country, and it's really great weather in New York. It's not like it used to be. For better or worse.
And Mark, I do feel I'm hogging a bit of Dimitri's attention. So okay. After this question, by all means, jump in. You know, the other thing that I really enjoy about your show, and this is one of the key things I was sort of eager to ask, you know, when I worked in media, what I was frustrated with was the lack of learning, like the way in which some report on a story or share a story, and it would go right in one ear and right out the next, right? As if they wouldn't absorb the knowledge. And yet, well, part of what I love about your interview style is you're not only listening to the guest, you're learning with the guest and you're sort of adapting. So if I were to scale that up to a big picture, you know, what is Hidden Forces teaching you, right? What are some of the big morals and some of the big lessons or insights that you're gaining as an accumulation of all the brilliant people that you're talking to and the knowledge that you're producing? Because, you know, that's the main value that I get out of the show, is it's just such a cornucopia of knowledge that I listen and then I end up going and writing a few articles or doing my own research because it's lighting up all the connections in my brain. So it kind of makes me want to ask the question, you know, what are the big lessons that you're deriving? What are the big pieces of knowledge that you're getting from the show? Whether it goes in terms of your original conception, in terms of the idea of Hidden Forces, or how it's influencing your future direction in terms of the dots that you're connecting and the threads that you're starting to pull out.
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, the truthful answer is going to be somewhat messy. To begin with, I really, in order to do the show the way I initially intended, and then later the way I felt that I needed to based on the feedback I was getting, because early on there was a combination of insecurity and so a desire to kind of show people, hey, I'm smart, I can hang with these guys, and then also just an excitement to be in this position to speak with all these interesting people. It caused me to talk more than I should have and listen less. And so I took that feedback and I incorporated it, and I got better at what I had initially intended to do in the first place, which meant really taking a step back and not thinking so much about what I actually thought or believed. And I kind of became a machine and really adept at studying someone else's work, his or her opinions, studying a topic, and then looking at how it's been discussed in the popular culture, and ask myself, okay, what are people missing? Or what are the interesting questions that no one's asking? Or what's really interesting here? And usually if I want to have someone on, it means that something that he's talked about or how he or she have expressed their ideas has been insufficient for me. It's like, I want more. There's something that's missing here. So I haven't spent much time actually trying to come to a clear idea about what I believe. And that's actually something that I've been trying to recently change. But I'm still kind of in that process. I think, I'd probably break it down, but there are even deeper forces that kind of cross all of these categories. I think that one of the major stories in the world today is the changing multipolar order. I don't know how old you guys are, but I was born in the early 1980s. I graduated high school in 2000. And so like my kind of adolescence, adulthood began with, in many ways, American decline. My childhood was American supremacy. And then the second half of my life has been American decline. And I think that is informing a lot of what we're seeing on the global stage. I also think that the debt picture and a lot of the underlying economic dynamics are driving a really unsustainable and unhealthy environment in our economy, and that I think feeds back into political stability in the U.S. You know, I don't have an immediate answer. I guess I have to sit. I think I have to sit and really think about your question. And it's been something that I've been meaning to do, and I have been trying to do, but I've been focused on kind of more individual questions.
Your rundowns are pretty out of this world in terms of like the depth and the extent to which you do the background for every guest that you have on the show. They're really something else. And, one of the things I wonder about is, I mean, in terms of how I take in information nowadays, I get my most quality information from alternative sources such as Hidden Forces, Grant Williams, Ben Hunt, people like that is who I'm reading. And that's how I find I get the most quality distillation of these big issues that are going on in the world, like what you say, the switch from a unipolar to a multipolar world, the debt super cycle. To me, what's going on with narrative, and maybe we can talk about that for a bit, is I find really troubling, especially this year. I don't know if it's always been this way, but it seems to have hit a crescendo this year of just almost narrative wars, increased polarization around everything. I mean, you were saying you were trying to get more to a place where you know where you stand. And I've actually been trying to go the opposite way this year. I was listening to a different podcast, Howard Marks on Super Value Investors, the guy from Columbia, I can't remember his name. And he said, there's two schools. There's the I don't know school and there's the I know school. And I'm in the I don't know school.
Is that what Howard Marks said?
Yeah.
That sounds like something Howard Marks
said. Yeah. And I'm like, that's where I need to be, because that's where I need to, that's where I used to be. And that's where I need to get back to is the I don't know school. And, yeah. And once
that's
I got
where
there,
I've been.
Yeah. There's actually some comfort to be taken from the I don't know school, because where I was living in the I know school is all or nothing thinking, super polarized thinking, complete absence of nuance, and really almost living in an echo chamber of my own design. And getting out of there was really important to me, because I just sort of felt like I was just cutting off larger and larger pieces of what was available out there in the world. And then at the foot of all that, I lay the blame at the mainstream media. Most of all, I can't even put on CNN or Fox or CBC or CTV here in Canada. I can't even watch them for 30 seconds. I just kind of want to throw up in my own mouth for after that amount of time, because it's just so distilled down to lowest common denominator, platitudes, editorializing, no news, panels instead of reporters. I mean, I remember you didn't know how old we are. We're born in the late 60s. So we're...
No,
we're
not like, me.
You're born early 70s?
Yes.
Oh, wow. Okay. So that's where we are. And when I grew up, and Jesse used to work in the media, but when I grew up, I remember you turn on the evening news and they would say, here's so-and-so reporting from Beirut. And now we're going to go to so-and-so reporting from Europe, the Berlin Wall. And now so-and-so is going to give us an update from Mexico City. Yeah. And now I turn on the TV and it's just a bunch of talking heads in a panel talking about how stupid Trump voters are. Not that I'm pro-Trump. I'm just saying it's that narrative. It's just that automatic gainsay of what the other side, so to speak, says. And I think it's such a huge problem these days that I really find myself afraid to talk about almost anything these days.
Totally. The fear comes from the what would you call it? Like the censorship culture. But like the larger thing about echo chambers and stuff, that is the environment is more polarized today than at any point in my lifetime. And the quality of the discourse is much, much lower. One of the things I often think about, or I've thought about a number of times, is what would Christopher Hitchens have said if he were to come back in a time machine, you know, if he were resurrected and brought today? I mean, first of all, it would be fascinating to have him here, because you know for sure he would love it. He would absolutely love it. I mean, he loved fighting with people. Yeah. He would get this, you'd see, he would actually like, he would lick his mouth when someone kind of, you know, went after him a little bit. I mean, he loved it. And he talked about how much he loved it. It would be interesting to see what someone like that would do in this time. A huge part of that is the tech platforms that intermediate our discussions and our perception of reality, which is why I've devoted so much time to trying to understand that and look at solutions. I mean, I feel very strongly about this. So you said, Mark, that you're an anarcho-libertarian. Is that right? Is that what you
said? It's in the ballpark, yeah.
Yeah, in the ballpark. I feel very strongly about the need for regulation, broad regulation of these tech platforms. I don't think the issue is necessarily antitrust. That's a popular general view. A lot of people hold that view without really knowing why. I think they just synonymize antitrust or monopoly with bad and break up with solution. The real problem, first and foremost, is the business model. You know, if you have this type of, if you have the ability to control, to increasingly control people's, hijack people's agency and direct them in places surreptitiously, I think that that cannot be wedded with an ad model. You know, I don't think that behavioral modification should be banned outright because, for example, if I have an Apple product or some other company and I want to lose weight, let's say, and I tell them, this is my goal. I want you guys to steer my behavior in a way that's going to help me become healthier or lose weight. I've set the objective. You're helping me achieve that objective. And that I don't think is a problem. I think consensual. Where it becomes an issue, it's consensual and I'm in charge. You haven't taken over my agency. You know, I've decided what I want. Whereas in with the ad model, I'm not in charge. You're telling me that I can just have this product, but then all of a sudden I find myself doing things without realizing that I'm just fulfilling the commercial imperatives of the platform. Right? I'm being matched to an advertiser. So I think that's the single biggest issue. And perhaps antitrust is required as well. I think all that has to be comprehensive. But maybe we find out that companies like Facebook can exist. Maybe they're national monopolies. But the real issue is they need to be regulated like utilities.
Well, and that's where I lament how regulation has become a dirty word. When it's just a tool, and it's a tool that can be used in a wide range of creative means. I mean, a few episodes ago, Mark, I was teasing you and I was suggesting that you should try to imagine what a libertarian regulatory framework would be with regard to the digital platforms. Because a libertarian would have completely different regulatory priorities and, you know, a regulatory bureaucracy or structure, because you would obviously want less. But to go through the exercise of imagining what a libertarian regulatory framework is, I think is a very valuable exercise, not just because we would get really interesting contributions from the libertarians as to what the regulation should be, but it then normalizes that regulation in and of itself is not bad. Bad regulations are bad, but there's still a real important value for good regulations, and it's difficult to have that type of adult conversation when the notion of regulation still remains a dirty word.
Well, I understand where Mark is coming from. I see Mark in his chair.
No. You might be reading me wrong because I put out a weekly newsletter for the customer base. That's where Access of Easy sort of germinated from.
Okay.
And it's a tech newsletter about censorship and privacy and surveillance capitalism and all that. And I was actually going back and forth with a couple of readers this week because last week I wrote about how Amazon was facing antitrust actions in Europe. And I said, you know, I always admit when I'm experiencing cognitive dissonance because when I find myself sort of siding with the regulators, like in certain antitrust cases and in California, Prop 24, like I really thought that Uber and Lyft were just acting, you know, they were externalizing their costs. And I sort of came down on the opposite side of that. And people were saying, how can you, the libertarian, be in favor of the regulator? So I'm fully cognizant that I call myself a libertarian and I don't just automatically gainsay regulation as just, you know, there shouldn't be any. Like, I understand that there's these issues here and there's this, that's where I talk about there's this need for nuance. Like, you know, California passed a law last year that said IoT devices can't have crappy default passwords anymore because it's just causing a hell, you know, it's causing a shitstorm of DOS attacks. And I wrote that up in Access of Easy and I'm saying, you know, okay, as the libertarian in me will admit it, that's not bad. That's a pretty good law and it's regulation and there it is. And it's not brain dead and it's effective regulation. And if they weren't going to, if the private sector wasn't going to do it themselves, then it had to be done for them. The ad model, and you were talking about this in the show with Jim Chanos the other day too, and it made me want to ask you if you've ever read Jaron Lanier's 10 Arguments for Deleting Your Social Media Accounts Right Now. It was modeled after the old Gerrymander book, 4 Arguments for the Elimination of Television, but he basically distills it down to the ad model is fundamentally broken in terms of the social media platforms, and that it does create these perverse incentives that I think we've really seen the outcome of since, you know, maybe not this very most recent electoral cycle, but the one before it, 2016 and onward. It just kind of became this escalating maelstrom of deliberate polarization. We were talking about this a few episodes ago, how I'm positive that we know that the tech platforms engineer for dopamine hits. I think they're also engineering for polarity and animosity and animus in the timelines. They're going to make you, they're going to put stuff in front of you that they know you're going to react to because anger drives clicks.
For sure. I mean, that's where goal setting comes in. I also think that at the limit, what it does is it turns people into robots. You know, they have less and less control over their own lives, and a very small number of people who are controlled with very powerful technologies control more and more society. It's so perverse and so dangerous, and I don't understand why it hasn't generated a greater amount of concern. I mean, I'm extremely concerned about it. You know what I mean? Like at the limit, it's fundamentally incompatible with a democratic form of government. You can't have a democracy without human agency.
We very much agree, and it's a recurring subject here on the show. But this seems like I'm changing the subject, but I'm actually not. Obviously, you don't run ads, and you have a subscriber model, which I assume is working for you. What's your relationship with your subscribers like? You know, and I mean that both on a kind of creator level, in terms of, you know, your relationship with your audience, but I also mean that on a business level, from a design perspective, in the sense of what kind of relationship are you looking for? What kind of relationship are you kind of trying to structure in terms of the subscriber experience? Obviously the rundowns and, you know, the sort of subscriber value is that, but I literally mean in terms of your relationship with your subscribers and the trust that you foster with them and the way in which you imagine that relationship.
Yeah. So when I first started this podcast for the first 2 years, I didn't monetize it at all. I hadn't really considered it much. Mm-hmm. It's only very, very recently. I mean, I began the subscription service a little less than 2 years ago. And it's only been very recently that I've looked at it and I've looked at the amount of work that I put in, the amount of value I put in, and the amount of money that I've been offered for sponsorships relative to the amount that I'm bringing in. I'm not bringing in a significant amount of money. We have, I think, 1,300 subscribers. Many of those are at the highest tier, which is the highest, like sort of general tier, which is $20 a month. And some of them are at $500 a month. So it's not an insignificant amount of money, but it's not anywhere near kind of, I guess, the value that I create. So I've sort of been rethinking it and thinking, how can I keep the subscription model while generating more value for myself? But to your point about like, what's my relationship with my audience, the reason why it's never been such a priority is partly because I just love doing it. And I don't like doing a lot of the other stuff that you need to do in order to make it more of a business. I love reading books. I love creating these rundowns. I love preparing. I love thinking. I love speaking with really interesting, smart people. And that's kind of where my focus is. And I've had to begrudgingly take time out of that to try and think about how I want to make this more of a business. And that's kind of what I've been working on lately. And there are, I think, avenues to do that outside of the subscription. And part of that might require me writing more, writing a newsletter. But I love hearing from listeners. You know, I love getting emails from them. I try and put aside a chunk of time every week to go through as much of the many of the emails and direct messages. And it just, one of the challenges for me today is because there are so many platforms, you get contacted in so many places.
Yeah.
And there are messages that I haven't seen for months that I might've gotten on Facebook or LinkedIn or Twitter. And I'm always behind on going through them, but I love hearing from them. And I recently heard from someone. I actually have to get back to him. Let me find it. Where is it? He gave me this shirt here. He sent it to me from his barber shop, Albert Street Barber. He has a barber shop in Pittsburh. He gave me a mug too. There you go, mug. Free exposure.
Yeah, we're gonna link to him in the show notes. So.
Yeah, he has a barber shop in Pittsburgh. And he emailed me, and it was such a really wonderful email. I have to say, I get emails from all sorts of people. There are all sorts of people that listen to the show, PhDs, really successful entrepreneurs, very wealthy investors. But some of the most interesting emails I get are from people who don't have those types of jobs. You know, another one I got some time ago from an assembly line worker in Australia. But this guy is a barber. What's really cool about it is he's as intellectually curious as I am. And he has his clients are people from all the universities in the area, right? All mm-hmm. the major, you know, tech universities in Pittsburgh as well. And he loves listening to the show, and he loves talking to his clients about these subjects. And I've actually thought to myself, you know, if I didn't do this job, before this, I always thought that I would enjoy being a barber just for the conversations. And I would enjoy being a personal trainer, in part because I've always loved, you know, that kind of stuff, trying to figure out how to maximize your performance, but also because I love talking to people and I love interacting with people. So, you know, I got a really wonderful email from him, and I took the time to respond to him. And I do that a lot with people. If I feel like someone really cares, that's all I need, you know? And I take the same approach with guests. When I used to reach out to guests when I had my old radio show, before I had any track record at all, the way I would get guests, like there are two approaches. One is you can take the, throw as much shit at the wall and hope that some of it's going to stick versus like take one very deliberate shot, you know, sit like, check the air, you know, adjust the scope and take one really great shot. And that's always been my preference. And I'll read someone's book or I'll think about something interesting. I'll be like, how do I get past this guy's, you know, wall of, you know, bullshit filter and pierce through it and be like, you know what? Yeah, I'll come on this guy's show. Cause when you start off and you don't have an audience, what makes someone want to come on your program is if they feel like you really care about their work. You know, so if someone reaches out to me and makes me feel like they really care about my work, I'll respond. You know,
I begs the question, how often do you get people reaching out to you who don't really care about your work?
Because that happens sometimes.
Okay, fair enough. I would be surprised.
It's PR people. Like sometimes you'll get these really, and I'm just like, and I'll just delete it right away. Because
they're robots.
Yeah.
Right? And I don't mean that in the literal sense, but I mean it in humans behaving.
They might be robots too.
Your point about the barber, though, I think proves your point about how you probably are ridiculously undervalued, right? In the sense that you're so accessible, right? The way in which, especially some of the guests you have, they're not necessarily accessible people by default. Like, mm-hmm. you're bringing out the best of
Howard Marks was on the show.
Right. Like you do your work in such a way that, and the other piece that you gave me today that is just now dawning on me is the theater production, right? That you understand how to pull the narrative out of your guest in a way that really makes it accessible. And you know, what hit me about your barber anecdote is it's the currency of knowledge. And the way in which you're giving your audience so much knowledge on a platter that it then allows them to turn around and show off that knowledge, be like, oh, yeah, well, listen to what I learned on Hidden Forces yesterday. Mm-hmm. So that, for me, begs the question of who are your influences? Like who, and Mark was alluding to this earlier in terms of his existential crisis of he realized he had to turn off the CNN and avoid the junk food that was making him sick. So who are your nutritional sources? And I mean that both on the knowledge level of who you're learning from, but I also mean that on the media production side. Like who are the shows or who are the media people, the interviewers that you kind of look up to or that you look to, you know, as your own source of inspiration or your own source of learning?
That's a great question. I love media questions. I feel like more equipped to answer them. I'm also it's amazing to me when I'm asked questions to reflect on how little I'm asked questions and how much I'm in the position of asking other people questions. You said something about knowledge. I will say in the episode that I did with Jim Chanos, in the introduction to that episode, that was the first time that I deliberately began this process of trying to really construct a narrative around what Hidden Forces' value proposition is. And I ended that intro saying that knowledge is power. In today's hyper-connected information economy, knowledge is power. I think that is the big value proposition of Hidden Forces. And the reason why I focus on these domains of geopolitics, policymaking, financial markets, technology, is because these are the wellsprings of power. You know, if you want to control society, these are the big like sandlots in which you have to play. Mm-hmm. It's not going to be in theatrical production. So I think that's kind of
depends on who your audience is, though. But I digress.
Right. Well, I guess it depends on how you mean it. But sure, I suppose. And to your point. OK, so then to a point that you made, if this is where you were going with it, I absolutely have a sense of a performance, like when I'm speaking with guests. And I've gotten better at sensing what it takes to keep the audience engaged. I'm always thinking about keeping the audience engaged. I'm always conscious of that because I don't want to lose them. And oftentimes I'll have guests who are super interesting, but they're not coming across as interesting. And it's a delicate balance to try and get them to where they need to be without making them feel like you're co-opting the conversation. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they don't understand that. But that's how, you know, it's as you get better and better and you have a larger audience, they kind of learn to trust you. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so yeah, that to that point, who are my influences?
Whose episodes do you eagerly wait for each week? Is there
not anymore?
Who's your favorite media in the most open general sense?
I have so many people who have influenced me in all sorts of different ways. Early on, I mean, let's not even go down to like Sesame Street, right? And movies. I was a huge television and movie fan. I can recite like word for word so many movies. And the people that know me personally know how good my memory is when it comes to those things. And I did an episode 4 on Hidden Forces was on American television history and culture. I'm actually not here. I'm not in my library. This is a secondary room. My library is full of books. I could go grab it. It's the Columbia History of American Television by Gary Edgerton. And I just loved it. I love how, and now I don't know if I'm going off track. You're right. Influences here. But I love how we construct narratives and process grief and tell our still stories about who we are through these mediums of communication. A great example is the Vietnam War. You know, we transformed what the Vietnam War was in our collective memory. You know, like when Rambo came along in the 1980s, like we had Platoon in the, I guess, early 80s, and we had Apocalypse Now in the 70s. And it was a gloomy, awful version of the war. But eventually with the 1980s and this like cocaine culture and go-go money and everything else, we rebuilt the narrative around this, like, you know, jacked good old boy American is going to go in there and he's going to rescue our boys from these, from the Viet Cong. And people that encountered the Vietnam War in the 1980s and didn't really have a context for it probably thought, oh, the Vietnam War was like something like a bunch of Vietnamese took our boys and put them in prison camps. And like, we had to go out and cause we're always the good guys. So, yeah. So, I mean, that's kind of an aside, but I always had a fascination with that kind of stuff. In terms of influences, I was too, I think, young for the Dan Rathers and the Walter Cronkites, but I was influenced by the Tim Russerts, by the Bill Moyers, by the Charlie Roses, and
old statesman interviewers.
Totally. Also, Don Hewitt of 60 Minutes, genius. You know, yeah. I had a natural knack. I didn't know it growing up because I grew up in a family surrounded by physicians. And there just really wasn't any kind of like, I didn't have in my mind that it would be possible to do something else or that anything else really mattered. I was also good at writing, but I told my mom one time that I wanted to be a philosopher when I grew up. And she melted down. She's like, you're going to be poor. Like, how are you going to do that? Which is actually what I'm doing now, you know, for a living.
I was going to say, good score.
Yeah, exactly. What was I going?
But the key question, which you've dodged, which I'll bring you back to. Oh,
can bring it back.
So yeah. When you're not working, or even if you are working and you sit down and you turn something on.
Oh yeah.
Is it a movie or, you know, is there a podcast? Is there a YouTube? Is there totally, someone yeah. out there who you tune into and you're a fan of?
Yeah. I'm sorry.
It's okay
also
to
that
say no. It's
no,
okay
I have, I have, no. I have. I'm sorry that I blank a little bit. We're recording this at the end of the day and I had a lot of recordings today and I did a lot of stuff. So I'm kind of fried. There are a lot of things that I watch. Number one, my fiance gets very upset at me because I can never watch TV shows with her because I always watch them on my own. When we're together, I don't want to watch anything. So like I watched something, I haven't told her about this yet. I started watching The Undoing, I think it's called. It's this show with Nicole Kidman and what's that guy? Hugh Grant.
Okay.
It's really great. And it's actually filmed. Part of it is filmed where we live in this kind of area right by the water. They film it actually at a house right by our house. It's fascinating. So I like to watch stuff like that if it's good. But that's kind of mind numbing. I enjoy watching clips of Joe Rogan. I went through a phase of really enjoying watching his stuff when all that sort of, culture war stuff was going on because I found it kind of like it satisfied my need to like I don't know what you would describe but it was kind of like yeah make fun of them. I hate them also. I hate them. So there was that, but I don't like Joe Rogan's show that much anymore. I think it's incredibly impressive what he's done. I also respect him on so many levels, but it doesn't do it for me anymore. It's not kind of highbrow enough. Mm-hmm. And I think he also, for whatever reason, gives a platform to people who are undeserving. I don't think that people deserve to be deplatformed or shouldn't, you know, it's not so much, but like, there's a lot of people that come on there and just say all sorts of dumb shit, you know, whether it's Alex Jones or, you know, other folks. And it's one thing, I guess it was fun for a while because it was kind of bro-y. I mean, you know, I get why Alex Jones can be fun and funny and, you know, but I don't know. It's, you know, at this level, I feel like he should be doing other stuff. I used to watch Sam Harris or listen to Sam Harris. I always have appreciated his intellectual honesty, but I never was aligned with him philosophically. Like Sam Harris is a materialist in a philosophical sense. And I think he's very close-minded. Even though he thinks that he's using this, in his view, he takes a very radically epistemological approach to everything. And I think that's incredibly valuable. But epistemology isn't religion. And when I say it isn't religion, I mean, what do I mean to say? I think there's more to life than reason and logic. And I think he misses that. And I mean that even perhaps on an ontological level. Like Sam Harris will try and say that we can use our minds to discern reality at bottom, that we can understand what reality is. And I actually don't think that's right. I think that's like obviously wrong. Mm-hmm. Because our brains that we're using, these material organs that you say constitute reality, are what we're using to discern reality. So therefore, we simply cannot know what reality is. But like, you know, so anyway, Sam Harris is another podcast that I used to listen to, but don't really listen to anymore. I don't really listen to much anymore. I kind of just listen to stuff. There's nothing out there that I like. I used to listen to The Daily. I got tired of it because they eventually just became so obviously partisan in their own slant. The honest answer is there's nothing that sustains my attention on a regular basis. There's no program that I sort of consistently listen to anymore.
Mark, you want to jump in? I've been dominating the questions.
As soon as you said that, I completely lost my train of thought. Really, I just
I'll do a small bunt but set you up to give you a moment to think. I'll tie this right back to digital platforms and democracy, because you know part of the reason I was going at those two in that context is, you know, the notion of community as being intellectual. That certainly here in Canada, you know, democracy is based on ridings. And the riding is literally how far a horse could ride in a day. I mean, that's not its current structure, but that's where the word derives. And it strikes me that part of the problem with our current iteration of democracy is it's based on an old-fashioned notion of community as being entirely physical, when most people, their sense of community is virtual, right? It's based on social media. It's based on digital platforms. It's based on things like hidden forces. So when we talk about community on Facebook, it's polarized. It's driven by identity rather than reason. It's got all these elements that, as we discussed earlier, are part of the design of the platform. Their goal is not towards some larger notion of society. Their goal is just dopamine. Their goal is just to keep people on the site longer. And so the other reason I was asking about your media influences is the other notion of a democracy is it's based on the informed citizen. So it's based on this idea that there's a fifth estate, the media, which ends up informing the people. And so I kind of feel that part of the accident of social media, and I say accident because I don't, to your point about business model, I don't think that they ever had a business model. Like they came up with the business model after, right? The idea was power, right? They just wanted to use technology to get attention, to have power, and we'll figure out how to pay back our investors later. Turned out it was advertising. And so it comes back down to this notion of how do we as a society inform ourselves? That's why I'm a big fan of hidden forces. And to me, I would love to see a kind of world in which there's hundreds of hidden forces or thousands of hidden forces, or to the point of your value that you were able to generate the kind of revenue necessary that you could have staff. So that you could
I would love to have staff.
Yeah, so you could have someone doing the marketing, so all you could focus on is programming, right? Because that's your wheelhouse, your joy. Yeah. So hopefully, Mark, I've teed you up enough that you could step in and bail me out of my rambling. But it's trying to connect the dots of media organizations that are driven by subscribers and members who are part of a community who constitute a new kind of democracy or democratic engagement that allows for critical thinking, that allows for people to be more informed than they are being informed in the Facebook communities and other echo chambers that are plaguing.
Yeah, interesting. Well, I would say there, it's important to note that there are a lot of people out there like me, for example, who go in depth. The problem is that people, the majority of people, even me, sometimes I just do it less than others. I'll want to watch something that's pure shit. You know, it's like watching Tucker Carlson is like eating Kentucky Fried Chicken, and watching Rachel Maddow is like eating Burger King. It's really bad for you. And, you know, sometimes you want something that's bad for you.
And but for the
unfortunately,
record,
yeah,
Andrew Camerata is my junk food and he's your neighbor.
Andrew Camerata.
You should give him a Google. He's on YouTube. He's a redneck. He produces redneck videos, although that sells him short. He's a brilliant, absolutely brilliant individual. But he's my junk food, and he's not literally your neighbor, but he's kind of your neighbor.
Who is check that guy? Is that the guy in the that films out of his F-150?
Kind of, but no, because I don't think he's more an excavator guy. He built a container castle. But he's a weird kind of influencer who kind of goes against the grain. But to your point, he's my junk food.
Oh, interesting. I'm looking right now. Actually, I should have said this because I'm looking as the truth is my true junk food is animal videos. All sorts of animal videos. Sometimes pet animals, sometimes wild animals, sometimes cute animals, sometimes animals being eaten by other animals. I just have this fascinating, insatiable need to engage with nature through videos. I mean, I love nature and obviously, you know, YouTube videos of animals are no substitute, but that's kind of actually my junk food. The problem is that when most people have no ability to, what's the term? Moderate their consumption of garbage, whether it's food. In food, they get unhealthy, but if it's in their information diet, they become equally unhealthy in a different way. And just many people do that. And I think the more tired people are, the less bandwidth they have to engage with things on an intellectual level. And the more they seek something very simple that meets them on an emotional level. And I see this with a lot of people I know who watch Fox very specifically. And also other people, of course. I know many people who watch CNN and MSNBC. And I can't think of many things that are worse for you to do, with the exception of maybe certain programs. Like I always thought on MSNBC, what's his name? Who was that guy? He was the only guy that I ever really liked on MSNBC.
Former sports broadcaster?
No, I didn't like Keith. What was his name? I used to like him back in the day during the Iraq War period. I liked him. What was his name again? Keith O'Brien.
His last name. Yeah.
I would have no idea.
O'Brien. Oberman. Keith Oberman.
Keith Oberman. Yes.
Yeah. 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 The problem with Keith Oberman is he's a narcissist. Wow. And the problem is that that's a problem that a lot of people, but he's a big narcissist.
A prerequisite for working in that field?
Unfortunately, it oftentimes is. Having worked in TV, I can tell you that, and another thing that's also often true in television is that some of the least qualified people to be on TV are the ones who want it desperately, and they will fight for it. They want to be on TV. But no, Keith Olbermann was uniquely, I think, narcissistic, very angry, just the worst kind of energy. And for a while I liked Keith because I was in the same place. You know, I was angry at the Iraq War. I didn't want us to be there. I thought it was a bad idea from the very beginning. And he captured that rage. But you can see how quickly these things can be weaponized and turned against you. I mean, at the same time, I should say that I do understand, though, and it's important to remember like where this model of media came from. And I don't mean like going all the way back to talk radio and Fox News, but I mean like why was there a demand for it by the public? And I think it's because the public got tired of the bullshit objective kind of down the line approach, because they felt that didn't reflect the urgency of the problems. And the Iraq War is a great example. But I think that we're at a point today where it's just gone, you know, off the rails, and we need to be able to come to consensus in order to move the country forward. Or maybe that's just me talking as a person in my late 30s, as opposed to someone in my early 20s, you know.
Well, it's a theme that we've hit a few times, actually, in the last few episodes of what we think is a crisis in a in critical thinking in this day and age, that critical thinking is, for the law, for the most part, it's not rewarded. It's penalized, in fact. Especially you see that with deplatforming and cancel culture. If anyone sort of colors outside the lines or comes up with a narrative that's not the official approved narrative, they get hounded out of respectability. And for a lot of people, it's too hard. Like, they just want it. Just give me something. Like, we're talking mental junk food. Like, for me, it's, thanks to Jesse, it's idiots in cars on Reddit. Like, I just, you know, I kind of land on that. I have a Reddit custom feed called We Are Doomed, and it has idiots in cars, idiots with guns, cringetopia, public freakout. And I suddenly, an hour's gone by, and I'm just watching people be at their abject worst.
But isn't that just Schadenfreude?
Yeah, well, I suppose, possibly. But, you know, that's and sometimes why I like history is I sometimes get this sense of, you know, it's always been this way. So it's not a crisis of critical thinking. It's just a continuity of a lack of critical thinking. And that oddly makes me feel a bit better, because at least that means
a continuity of lack of critical thinking.
It's just not getting worse. It's just the same as it ever was.
It's always been this bad. It's comforting.
Yes. And that oddly comforts me. So anyhow, Dimitri, this has been absolutely great.
Right on.
Cool. All right, Dimitri, well, thanks again, and we're going to leave it at that. Dimitri Kafinas, Axis of Easy, number 32. Go check him out at hiddenforces.io, and sign up for the premium Patreon. I think it's worth it. I love the what do you call it, the after...
I did an afterthought recently, but usually it's overtime.
Overtime, segments. Yeah. So.
Yeah, no, I did an afterthought recently, though.
Right,
People seem to want those. But yeah, I appreciate it, guys. Thank you. It was great speaking with you.
Thanks, Dimitri. Take care.
All right, bye.